responsibility for world collaboration, or we shall have to bear the responsibility for another world conflict. And I am confident that the Congress and the American people will accept the results of this conference as the beginning of a permanent structure of peace upon which we can begin to build, under God, that better world in which our children and grandchildren, yours and mine, the children and grandchildren of the whole world, must live and can live. And that, my friends, is the only message I can give you, for I feel very deeply, and I know that all of you are feeling it today and are going to feel it in the future. Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's advisor and confidant, shared the post-Yalta enthusiasm. We really believed in our hearts that this was the dawn of the new day we had all been praying for and talking about for so many years. We were absolutely certain that we had won the first great victory of the peace, and by we, I mean all of us, the whole civilized human race. The Soviets had proved reasonable and far-seeing, and there wasn't any doubt in the minds of the President or any of us that we could live with them and get along with them peacefully, for as far into the future as any of us could imagine. But I have to make one amendment to that. I think we all had in our minds the reservation that we could not foretell what the results would be if anything should happen to Stalin. We felt sure that we could count on him to be reasonable and sensible and understanding, but we never could be sure who or what might be in back of him there in the Kremlin. The Soviets shared in the post-Yalta ebullience, but could not be sure about the man next in line behind Roosevelt. Observers of Roosevelt's speech to Congress noticed how rapidly the president's health was failing. Exhausted from his trip, for the first time in his presidency he addressed the Congress sitting, not standing. Over the next weeks, disagreements with the Soviets surfaced over Poland and other issues, raising vexing questions for the president about the future of the relationship. But he never lost hope that the three nations would continue to work together in peace and friendship. In his last cable to Churchill, Roosevelt wrote, "I would minimize the general Soviet problem as much as possible, because these problems, in one form or another, seem to arise every day, and most of them straighten out." On April 12, 1945, Harry Truman, who had succeeded Wallace as vice president, after the 1944 elections, went to House Speaker Sam Rayburn's office in the Capitol to play poker and make a dent in his latest shipment of whiskey. Upon arrival, he was instructed to call Steve Early at the White House immediately. Early told him to rush right over. At the White House, Eleanor Roosevelt informed Truman that the president had died. After regaining his bearings, Truman expressed his regrets and asked if there was anything he could do. Mrs. Roosevelt replied, "Is there anything we can do for you? For you are the one in trouble now." Truman was shockingly unprepared for that moment. He had met with Roosevelt only twice during his 82 days as vice president, and they had not spoken about any of the substantive issues facing the nation. In fact, most astoundingly, neither Roosevelt nor any of the other top officials had even informed Truman that the nation was building an atomic bomb. On his first day in office, the new president ran into a group of reporters outside the Capitol. One asked how his first day on the job was going, to which Truman replied, "Boys, if you ever pray, pray for me now. I don't know whether you fellows ever had a load of hay fall on you. But when they told me yesterday what had happened, I felt like the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on me. I've got the most terribly responsible job a man ever had." When a reporter yelled out, "Good luck, Mr. President," Truman responded, "I wish you didn't have to call me that." It was not false humility on Truman's part. He sincerely felt he was in way over his head, and told everyone he met with that it was all a mistake and that he was not qualified to be president. Stimson, Wallace, and others were afraid that Truman, given his own inclinations and lack of preparation, would be putty in the hands of some of the hardliners. Stimson anticipated that the greatest pressure would come from Churchill, and warned Marshall that they ought to be alert now that a new man was at the helm in the presidency, to see that he was advised as to the background of the past differences between Britain and America on these matters. Roosevelt had spelled out perhaps the most crucial difference at his March 16th cabinet meeting. Forrestal missed the meeting but had Assistant Secretary H. Struve Hensel attend and take notes, which Forrestal included in his diary. The President indicated considerable difficulty with British relations. In a semi-jocular manner of speaking, he stated that the British were perfectly willing for the United States to have a war with Russia at any time, and that, in his opinion, to follow the British program would be to proceed toward that end. The first to see him on April 13th was Secretary of State Edward Stettinius. The former Lend-Lease administrator jumped at Truman's request to be educated about what was going on in the world. Stettinius had had little influence with Roosevelt. In fact, many considered him a complete lightweight. A friend of Roosevelt complained, "A Secretary of State should be able to read and write and talk. He may not be able to do all of these, but Stettinius can't do any of them." Stettinius painted a picture for Truman of Soviet deception and perfidy. Since Yalta, he explained in a memo later that day, the Soviets have taken a firm and uncompromising position on nearly every major question. He charged them with acting unilaterally in the liberated areas, and said that Churchill felt even more strongly than he did on these matters. Churchill wasted little time confirming that view both in cables and in a hurried visit to Washington by Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden. The British ambassador to the United States, Lord Halifax, sized Truman up and decided that the new president was an honest and diligent mediocrity. A bungling, if well-meaning, amateur, surrounded by Missouri County Courthouse-caliber friends. That afternoon, Truman met with his old Senate mentor, James F. Jimmy Burns. Admitting his abject ignorance, Truman implored Burns to tell him about everything from Tehran to Yalta, and everything under the sun. Because Burns had been part of the U.S. delegation at Yalta, Truman assumed he had accurate knowledge about what transpired. It would be many months before Truman discovered that that was not the case. In this and subsequent meetings, Burns reinforced Stettinius's message that the Soviets were breaking the Yalta Agreement and that Truman needed to be resolute and uncompromising with them. He also gave Truman his first real briefing about the atomic bomb, which, he conjectured, might well put us in a position to dictate our own terms at the end of the war. He did not specify exactly to whom the United States would be dictating terms. Truman so trusted Burns that he made clear his intention to appoint him Secretary of State as soon as Stettinius had gotten the United Nations off the ground. Truman's close friend and appointment secretary, Matthew Connolly, later wrote, "Mr. Burns came from South Carolina and talked to Mr. Truman and immediately decided that he would take over. Mr. Truman to Mr. Burns, I'm afraid, was a non-entity, as Mr. Burns thought he had superior intelligence." Superior intelligence, perhaps, but between this unlikely pair, who would do so much to shape the post-war world, Truman had more formal education, having at least graduated from high school, whereas Burns had dropped out at age 14. Ambassador Harriman paid a call on Stalin at the Kremlin, and found the Soviet leader profoundly saddened by Roosevelt's death. Stalin held Harriman's hand as he bemoaned humanity's loss in Roosevelt's passing, and asked Harriman to convey his deepest condolences to Mrs. Roosevelt and the Roosevelt children. Harriman tried to assure Stalin that he would develop an equally strong relationship with President Truman, whom Harriman described as a man of action and not of words. Stalin responded, "Roosevelt has died, but his cause must live on. We will support President Truman with all our forces and all our will." The usually skeptical Harriman was moved by the depth of Stalin's emotion. Molotov stopped off in Washington before heading to San Francisco for the opening of the United Nations. He was eager to speak directly with the new president. Harriman rushed to Washington, too, intent upon reaching Truman prior to his meeting with the Soviet foreign minister. Arriving in time, He warned Truman that the United States was facing a barbarian invasion of Europe, and urged him to stand firm and tell Molotov that we would not stand for any pushing around on the Polish question. Harriman reinforced the advice that Truman had been receiving from Churchill and Eden. As soon as the Soviet Union extended control over a country and imposed its system, he declared, the secret police moved in and wiped out free speech. He felt certain that the Soviets wouldn't risk a break with the United States, because they desperately sought the post-war reconstruction aid that Roosevelt had dangled before them. Stettinius and Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal generally concurred with that assessment. All three encouraged a tough stand over Poland. On April 23rd, Truman gathered his foreign policy advisers for a final meeting before sitting down with Molotov. Stimson, Marshall, and Leahy offered a different point of view. Leahy again noted the opaque elasticity of the Yalta Agreement and the difficulty of alleging bad faith on that basis. In fact, he said, after the understanding at Yalta, he would have been surprised had the Soviets behaved differently than they had. The esteemed Marshall, whom Time magazine had named Man of the Year for 1943, contended that a break with the Soviet Union would be disastrous, given U.S. dependence on it to help defeat the Japanese. Stimson showed the clearest understanding of the Soviet predicament and urged greater circumspection on the part of the inexperienced president. He explained that the Soviet Union had been a trustworthy ally, often delivering even more than had been promised, especially in important military matters. He reminded the president of Poland's importance to the Soviets and said that the Russians perhaps were being more realistic than we were in regard to their own security. He added that outside the United States and Great Britain, including countries under U.S. influence, very few countries shared the United States' understanding of free elections. Truman, true to form, tried to mask his limited understanding of the issues with bluster and bravado. He promised to stand up to Molotov and demand that the Soviets stop breaking the Yalta Agreement. As far as the United Nations was concerned, the United States would go on with plans for the San Francisco Conference, and if the Russians did not wish to join us, they could go to hell. He acknowledged to Harriman that he didn't expect to get 100% of what he wanted from the Soviets, but he did expect to get 85%. Perhaps not surprisingly, the most vociferous critics of the Soviet Union shared a similar class background that inclined them to mistrust the Soviets' motives and intentions, and revile anything that smacked of socialism. Harriman, the son of a railroad millionaire, had founded Brown Brothers Harriman. Forrestal had made a fortune on Wall Street, and Stettinius had been chairman of the board of U.S. Steel, the nation's largest corporation. They would join with other wealthy international bankers, Wall Street and Washington lawyers, and corporate executives, who had also inherited or made their fortunes during the interwar years, to shape post-war U.S. policy. These men included Dean Acheson of Covington and Burling, Robert Lovett of Brown Brothers Harriman, John McCloy of Kravath, Swain and Moore, Allen and John Foster Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell, oil and banking magnate Nelson Rockefeller, Paul Nitzer of Dillon Reed, Ferdinand Eberstadt of Dillon Reed and F. Eberstadt and Company, and General Motors President Charles E. Wilson, who in 1944, as the director of the War Production Board, told the Army Ordnance Board that in order to prevent a return to the Depression, the United States needed a permanent war economy. Although these people also served in the Roosevelt administration, they had exerted much less influence on Roosevelt, who acted largely as his own Secretary of State. In his meeting with Molotov later that day, Truman put on his tough guy act and wasted little time accusing the Soviets of having broken the Yalta Agreement, particularly in Poland. When Molotov tried to explain that Poland, being on the Soviet Union's border, was a vital security issue for the Soviets, and that the agreement called for including friendly Poles, not the London group that was virulently hostile to the Lublin government, Truman rudely dismissed his clarifications. When Molotov tried to raise other issues, Truman snapped, "That will be all, Mr. Molotov. I would appreciate it if you would transmit my views to Marshal Stalin." Molotov replied, I've never been talked to like that in my life. Truman fired back. Carry out your agreements and you won't get talked to like that. Molotov, indignant at such treatment, stormed out of the room. Years later, Molotov remembered Truman's imperious tone and rather stupid effort to show who was boss. Truman soon thereafter boasted to Joseph Davies, the former ambassador to the Soviet Union. I gave it to him straight. I let him have it. It was the straight 1-2 to the jaw. Stalin wasted no time in responding to Truman's undiplomatic dressing down of Molotov. Having been invaded by Germany twice in 25 years through Poland and Eastern Europe, he insisted on having friendly governments to his west, and especially on his border. He cabled Truman the following day, outlining what had actually occurred at Yalta. He contended that Roosevelt had agreed that the Lublin government would form the kernel of the new Polish government. Because Poland borders on the Soviet Union, the Soviets had the right to a friendly government there. He said he didn't know if the governments of Belgium or Greece were really democratic, but he wouldn't make a stink because they were vital to British security. He wrote, I am ready to fulfill your request and do everything possible to reach a harmonious solution. But you demand too much of me. You demand that I renounce the interests of security of the Soviet Union, but I cannot turn against my country. Stalin believed that he and Roosevelt had reached an understanding about Poland that respected the Soviet Union's security needs. In fact, when Harriman wanted to make an issue of Poland at the Foreign Ministers' Conference in Moscow in October 1943, Secretary of State Hull rebuked him and reminded him of the United States' real priorities, commenting, I don't want to deal with these piddling little things. We must deal with the main issues. But under Truman, the anti-Soviet hardliners were driving policy. Stalin felt betrayed. The opening of the United Nations in San Francisco on April 25th should have been an occasion to celebrate a new era in international peace and reconciliation. Instead, the early sessions were marred by tension between the principal wartime allies. On the opening day, Harriman met with members of the U.S. delegation to make sure, he said, that everyone understands that the Soviets were not going to live up to their post-war agreements. They would, he insisted, use any devious means at their disposal to dominate Eastern Europe. When Harriman repeated the charges in off-the-record press conferences, several reporters walked out and accused him of being a warmonger. The U.S. delegates showed no such skepticism. Molotov's request to have the Lublin government seated to represent Poland was rejected. But the United States rallied Latin American representatives to support seating the Argentine government, despite its Nazi sympathies. Realizing that his get-tough tactics with the Soviet Union had not produced the desired results, Truman met twice with Joseph Davies to seek his counsel. As ambassador to the Soviet Union, Davies, a conservative corporate attorney, had surprised liberal critics by sympathizing with the Soviet experiment. Truman confessed to Davies that after his tirade, Molotov was visibly shaken, blanched, and went pale. He concluded that the tough method clearly worked because the Soviets backed down at San Francisco and didn't demand recognition of the Lublin government. But after that, relations had deteriorated rapidly. What do you think, he asked, did I do right? Davies explained that Molotov had come to see him before his April 23rd meeting with Truman and asked if Truman knew all the facts about Yalta. He said that Roosevelt's death had been a great tragedy to them because Stalin and Roosevelt understood each other. Davies explained to Truman that the Soviets had always been sticklers for reciprocity between allies. So they accepted British-imposed governments in Africa, Italy, and Greece, even though they didn't represent the anti-fascist forces in those countries, because they understood that they were vital interests to the United States and Great Britain. They expected similar consideration for their vital security interests in Poland. Davies reminded Truman that while the United States and Great Britain were planning global strategy, the Soviet Union was doing all the fighting. Truman was surprised to learn that the Soviets had even agreed not to press their territorial claims with Churchill out of consideration for Roosevelt. Truman promised he would clean out the people in the State Department who were so anti-Soviet that they'd been misleading him. Davies noted how fundamentally the relationship had changed in the last 6 weeks, with the British acting as instigators. Davies warned Truman that if the Soviets decided that the United States and Great Britain were ganging up on them, they would respond by out-toughing the West, as they had in concluding the pact with Hitler, when it became clear that the West would not help them stop the Nazis. But he assured Truman that, when approached with generosity and friendliness, the Soviets respond with even greater generosity. The tough approach induces a quick and sharp rejoinder that out-toughs anyone they consider hostile. Davies agreed to set up a meeting between Truman and Stalin. Truman admitted that he was in over his head and had mishandled things. Davies recorded Truman's self-deprecating comments in his diary. "It's no wonder that I'm concerned over this matter. It is a terrible responsibility, and I am the last man fitted to handle it, and it happened to me. But I'll do my best." "Here lies Joe Williams. He did his best. Man can do no more. But he was too slow on the draw," Truman quipped revealingly. Another former ambassador to the Soviet Union, Admiral William H. Stanley, who had served in 1942 and 1943, spoke out publicly to counter those who believed Stalin was up to no good. Writing in Collier's, Stanley insisted that Stalin genuinely desired to cooperate with the United States to establish a durable world peace. The Soviet Union not only desperately needed a stable peace, he believed, but I am certain that Stalin desires it sincerely and fervently. The world, he added, simply cannot stand another war. Things had been going well on the battlefield in Europe. On April 26th, U.S. and Soviet soldiers met on the Elbe River near Torgau, 4,500 miles from the shores of the United States, and 1,400 bloody miles from the ruins of Stalingrad. The occasion was joyous. Food abounded and liquor flowed. Champagne, vodka, cognac, wine, beer, scotch. Private First Class Leo Kaczynski called it the best time I ever had in my life. The Soviets gave us a wonderful meal and we had about 60 toasts. Boy, he added, they don't even drink like that in Brooklyn. The New York Times reported, "Toasts and songs and expressions of hope for the future, in which America, Russia, and Britain would stand together for enduring peace." On May 7, 1945, Germany surrendered. Hitler and Eva Braun had committed suicide in their bunker a week earlier. A U.S. diplomat wrote that the Soviet people's joy was indescribable. Crowds gathered in front of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and shouted, "Hurrah for Roosevelt!" Stalin addressed 2 to 3 million people in Red Square. Americans returned that feeling of goodwill toward the Soviets, acknowledging the immensity of their sacrifice and suffering. In June, C.L. Sulzberger wrote in the New York Times that their losses strained the imagination. In terms of misery and suffering, of malady and disaster, of wasted man-hours in a land where work is glorified, the loss is incalculable. It cannot be gauged by the scarcely touched peoples of America. It cannot be measured by the sadly battered people of England. It perhaps cannot be fully realized even by the masses of Russian people themselves. Sulzberger understood that such devastation would have enduring consequences. This terrible suffering and unprecedented destruction will leave its mark not only upon the people and lands of the USSR, but upon future decisions and policies, as well as psychological attitudes. This meant that the Soviets would demand allies of the surest sort in Eastern Europe, the permanent debilitation of German military power, and the forging of friendly relations with the nations of Central Asia and the Far East that bordered the Soviet Union. He predicted that Soviet citizens, despite the fact that they were eager for the better things of life, would patiently sacrifice material comforts for a return to the sense of security that had been shattered by the war years. Charitable efforts to ease Soviet deprivation proliferated throughout the year. On New Year's Day, The editors of the Washington Post urged Americans to remember Russian children as they celebrated their holiday and send them a tithe of our good fortune, commemorating the sense of community we have come to feel toward the Russian people. Even First Lady Bess Truman lent a hand. In July, she became honorary chairman of the English Classics Collection of Books for Russian War Relief, which commenced a nationwide drive to collect 1 million books to replace those destroyed by the Nazis. Each donated volume would bear the flags of the two nations, along with a frontispiece inscription reading, "To the heroic people of the Soviet Union, from the people of America." Numerous stories circulated about the bravery and generosity of Soviet soldiers and average citizens. The Washington Post detailed the story of Captain Ernest M. Gruenberg, a paratroop surgeon on D-Day. Upon escaping from a POW camp, Gruenberg and two other U.S. officers made the journey to Moscow in just 14 days. Gruenberg recounted, "We hardly ever walked. Always there was a truck or train to haul us, and no one ever asked for money or tickets. We were Americans, and nothing, apparently, was too good for us. Everywhere people took us in. We rode in trucks and boxcars, but we made a grand entry into Moscow in the car reserved for Russian officers. Free, of course." The Soviets and Poles were so willing to share their meager food supplies that Gruenberg believed he gained back the 25 pounds he had lost in prison. The comradely feelings toward the Soviet people translated into optimism about post-war comity between the two nations. A March Gallup poll revealed that 55% of Americans believed that the Soviet Union could be trusted to cooperate with the United States after the war. Although many of Truman's advisors assumed that Stalin would set up communist regimes throughout the territories occupied by the Red Army, Stalin was in no rush to institute revolutionary change. He recognized that the communists represented a minority element in most of these nations, though they had often played a leading role in anti-Nazi resistance movements. He had once remarked that communism fit Poland like a saddle fit a cow. And Soviet soldiers did little to ingratiate themselves with the German people, seeking revenge for the havoc, devastation, and humiliation that German soldiers had wreaked on the Soviet Union. They behaved brutally toward the vanquished Germans. German women paid an especially high price for Germany's crimes. In just a few weeks, over 100,000 sought medical care for rape. Although such behavior was unconscionable and inexcusable, it can be understood as more than simply the barbarian invasion alleged by Harriman. Soviet troops had not only witnessed German atrocities inside the Soviet Union, their rage had been fueled by what they had seen while liberating concentration camps, including Majdanek, Sobibor, Treblinka, and Auschwitz, en route to Berlin. As the war correspondent Alexander Wirth described it, "As the Red Army advanced to the west, it heard these daily stories of terror and humiliation and deportation. It saw the destroyed cities. It saw the mass graves of Russian war prisoners, murdered or starved to death. In the Russian soldiers' mind, the real truth on Nazi Germany, with its Hitler and Himmler and its Untermensch philosophy and its unspeakable sadism, became hideously tangible." Soldiers described the horrors they had witnessed. V. Letnikoff wrote to his wife in 1945, "Yesterday we examined a death camp for 120,000 prisoners. Posts 2 meters high with electric fencing enclosed the camp. In addition, the Germans mined everything. Watchtowers for armed guards and machine guns stand 50 meters apart. Not far away from the death barracks is the crematorium. Can you imagine how many people the Germans have burned there? Next to this exploded crematorium, there are bones, bones, and piles of shoes several meters high. There are children's shoes in the pile. Total horror, impossible to describe." Soviet newspapers, including those read by the soldiers, went out of their way to publish grisly accounts of the atrocities. By the time they reached German soil, Soviet troops' anger could barely be contained. Stalin, neither condoning nor condemning such behavior, did nothing to stop it. Far from initially imposing communist regimes, Stalin tried to restrain those seeking revolutionary change in both Western and Eastern Europe, urging them to establish broader democratic coalitions. More of a nationalist than an international revolutionary, he thought first about what was in the interests of the Soviet Union. He expected the United States' support for post-war reconstruction, and he needed the Allies' cooperation to guarantee against the restoration of German power, which he still saw as the primary threat to the Soviet Union. He told his communist allies not to follow the Bolshevik model, but to move toward socialism under other political systems, for example by a democracy, a parliamentary republic, and even by a constitutional monarchy. He wanted nothing to disrupt his alliance with the United States and Britain. Hence, the governments he set up in Soviet-liberated Eastern and Central Europe were friendly to the Soviet Union, but not communist-dominated. Truman was also feeling more conciliatory. After his meetings with Davies and conversations with Harry Hopkins and Secretary of Commerce Henry Wallace, he made an effort to improve relations with the Soviets. He and his military leaders resisted Churchill's pressure to maintain troops in their advanced positions until they had wrested concessions from the Soviets. Truman gradually discovered that Stalin's interpretation of the Yalta Agreement conformed more closely to the truth than his own. Burns admitted that he had left Yalta before the final agreement was concluded, and that he had not participated in many of the critical meetings. Truman also learned that Roosevelt had indeed acceded to a Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, and that there were no grounds for demanding a new government in Poland. He sent Harry Hopkins to meet with Stalin in late May, and they worked out an agreement on Poland that was similar to the formula established for Yugoslavia. The reorganized cabinet would include former Prime Minister Stanislav Mikolajczyk as Deputy Prime Minister, and three other non-communists, along with the 17 posts accorded to the communists and their allies. Truman told journalists that this represented a very pleasant yielding on the part of Stalin, which augured well for future cooperation between the United States and the Soviet Union. As Truman left for Potsdam in July, there was a much greater basis for optimism regarding the post-war alliance than there had been only 2 months earlier. But some raised a cautionary note. Life magazine in July 1945, just 2 years after it had put Stalin on the cover as a hero, cautioned that Russia is the number one problem for America because it is the only country in the world with the dynamic power to challenge our own conceptions of truth, justice, and the good life. The Potsdam meeting, though amicable on the surface, would prove a setback to long-term cooperation. News of the successful atomic bomb test convinced Truman that the United States could get along just fine without catering to Soviet concerns, and his behavior towards Stalin conveyed that message. On his way back from Potsdam on the USS Augusta, he told a group of officers that it didn't matter if the Soviets were obstinate, because the United States now had developed an entirely new weapon of such force and nature that we did not need the Russians, or any other nation. Chapter 4. The Bomb. The Tragedy of a Small Man. A young second lieutenant, Paul Fussell, was about to be transferred from Europe to the Pacific when he received the news of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. In 1988, he published Thank God for the Atom Bomb. For all the fake manliness of our facades, he wrote, we cried with relief and joy. We were going to live. We were going to grow up to adulthood after all. Generations of Americans have been taught that the United States reluctantly dropped atomic bombs on Japan at the end of World War II to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of young men like Fussell, who were poised to die if the U.S. invaded. But the story is really more complicated and much more disturbing. With its sights trained on first defeating the Nazis, the United States threw the lion's share of its resources into the European War. Roosevelt had insisted on the Europe First strategy. He opposed an all-out effort in the Pacific. Defeating Japan, he argued, would not defeat Germany, but defeating Germany would mean defeating Japan, probably without firing a shot or losing a life. Following the surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, the Japanese took the offensive early in the war, but the United States scored a major victory at Midway in June 1942, and then began the island-hopping strategy that would continue for more than 3 years. The Japanese fought fiercely, ensuring that U.S. victory would come at an enormous cost. U.S. industrial production gave the U.S. forces tremendous advantages. By 1943, U.S. factories were churning out almost 100,000 planes a year, dwarfing the 70,000 Japan produced during the entire war. By the summer of 1944, the United States had deployed almost 100 aircraft carriers in the Pacific, far more than Japan's 25 for the entire war. Science also figured prominently in the war effort. Development of radar and the proximity fuse contributed to the Allied victory, but it was the development of the atomic bomb that would change the course of history. Science fiction writers and scientists had long pondered the possibility of atomic energy for both peaceful and military purposes. Beginning in 1896, a series of scientific discoveries by Henri Becquerel, Marie and Pierre Curie, and Frederick Soddy and Ernest Rutherford ignited public curiosity about radioactivity. In the early 1900s, comments by Rutherford, Soddy, and others about the enormous energy locked in matter and the possibility of blowing up the universe aroused futuristic apprehension. But they and others also fantasized about the positive uses to which such energy might be put, and the utopian societies that could emerge. While awaiting the advent of atomic power to create a new Garden of Eden, the public became enamored of the healing powers of radium and other radioactive ingredients. Promoters claimed that their products could heal all sorts of maladies, ranging from baldness to rheumatism to dyspepsia to high blood pressure. One list contained 80 patent medicines with radioactive ingredients that could be inhaled or injected or taken in tablets, bath salts, liniments, suppositories, or chocolate candy. William Bailey claimed that the products produced at the Bailey Radium Laboratories in East Orange, New Jersey, would cure everything from flatulence to sexual debility. Among his products was the radio endocrinator, which could be worn around the neck to rejuvenate the thyroid, around the trunk to stimulate the adrenals and ovaries, or under the scrotum in a special jockstrap. He did a thriving business, especially with his liquid Radithor, whose saddest and most noteworthy victim was wealthy Pittsburgh manufacturer and playboy Eben Byers. Byers's physician recommended he try Radithor for his injured arm, and Byers began drinking several bottles a day in December 1927. Not only did it work for his arm, Byers claimed, it gave him new vitality and sexual energy. Believing it was an aphrodisiac, Byers pressed the substance on his lady friends. By 1931, he himself had consumed between 1,000 and 1,500 bottles and started feeling sick. He lost weight, experienced bad headaches, and watched his teeth fall out. Experts decided that his body was slowly decomposing. His upper jaw and most of his lower jaw were removed, and holes appeared in his skull. From there, the end came quickly, as he succumbed to radioactive poisoning. Among those who warned of atomic energy's dystopian possibilities was H.G. Wells, who wrote the first atomic war novel, The World Set Free, in 1914. Wells prophesied an atomic war between Germany and Austria on one side, and England, France, and the United States on the other, in which over 200 cities were destroyed by the unquenchable crimson conflagrations of the atomic bombs. He later proposed his own epitaph, "God damn you all, I told you so." A brilliant, quirky Hungarian physicist named Leo Szilard was influenced by Wells's writing. Szilard, who left Germany soon after the Nazi takeover, had given extensive thought to the possibility of atomic energy. He tried to discuss the feasibility with Rutherford, who dismissed it as the merest moonshine, and threw Szilard out of his office. Undaunted, Szilard took out a patent in 1934 on how a nuclear chain reaction would work, citing beryllium as the most likely element rather than uranium. In December 1938, two German physicists stunned the scientific world by splitting the uranium atom, making the development of atomic bombs a theoretical possibility. Those in the United States who were most alarmed by this development were the scientists who had escaped from Nazi-occupied Europe, who feared the consequences should Hitler get his hands on such a weapon. Proposing that the United States build its own atomic bomb as a deterrent, the émigré scientists tried but failed to arouse the interest of U.S. authorities. Feeling desperate, in July 1939, Szilard and fellow Hungarian physicist Eugene Wigner solicited the help of the universally admired Albert Einstein, who agreed to write to President Roosevelt, urging him to authorize a U.S. atomic research program. Einstein later regretted the action, admitting to chemist Linus Pauling, "I made one great mistake in my life when I signed the letter to President Roosevelt recommending that the atom bombs be made." He actually wrote three letters to Roosevelt on the subject. The scientists were right about one thing. Germany did begin an atomic research program. But, unbeknown to the Americans until late in the war, Germany abandoned its atomic research early on to focus on more immediately available weapons like the V-1 and V-2 rockets. Hitler and Albert Speer had little interest in putting manpower and resources into a weapon they might not be able to use in the current war. Despite Roosevelt's commitment, U.S. research developed at a glacial pace. It languished until fall 1941, when the United States officially received the British Maud Report, which corrected the erroneous belief that 500 tons of pure uranium might be required to make a bomb, an amount that would stop the program in its tracks. In fact, wartime science administrator James Conant thought it unwise to commit so many resources to the project. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Arthur Holly Compton reported that by the summer of 1941, the government's responsible representatives were very close to dropping fission studies from the war program. However, the new calculations showed that only 5 to 10 kilograms were needed and that a bomb was achievable within 2 years. With the new report in hand, Vannevar Bush, the country's other top science administrator, went to see Roosevelt and Vice President Henry Wallace on October 9th. Based on the new information, Roosevelt gave Bush the resources he requested. Bush put Compton in charge of bomb design. Compton set up the metallurgical laboratory at the University of Chicago. The goal was to produce a self-sustaining chain reaction in an atomic pile. Compton asked J. Robert Oppenheimer, the brilliant and charismatic theoretical physicist, to bring together a team of extraordinary theoreticians to grapple with a number of important questions. Among Oppenheimer's luminaries, as he called them, were Edward Teller and Hans Bethe, who shared a compartment on the train west to Berkeley, where they were to gather in the summer of 1942. Teller confided what was really on his mind. Bethe recalled, "Teller told me that the fission bomb was all well and good, and essentially was now a sure thing. In reality, the work had hardly begun." Teller likes to jump to conclusions. He said that what we really should think about was the possibility of igniting deuterium by a fission weapon, the hydrogen bomb. Teller was so gung-ho on the fusion bomb that his fellow scientists had a difficult time getting him to focus on the problem at hand, building an atomic bomb. Thus, from nearly the outset of the project, the leading scientists were aware that what lay at the end of the road was not just an atomic bomb, which would vastly multiply human destructive capabilities, but a hydrogen bomb, which could threaten all life on the planet. That summer, they had a scare so profoundly unsettling that it forced them to halt the project. During their deliberations, the physicists suddenly realized that an atomic detonation might ignite the hydrogen in the oceans or the nitrogen in the atmosphere and set the planet afire. Newell Farr Davis, in his study of Oppenheimer and physicist Ernest Lawrence, describes the abject fear that engulfed the room. Oppenheimer stared at the blackboard in wild surprise, and the other faces in the room, including Teller's, successively caught the same look. Teller had correctly calculated the heat production of a fission bomb. Oppenheimer saw it, with or without a deuterium wrapper, setting afire the atmosphere of the entire planet, and no one at the conference could prove he was wrong. Oppenheimer rushed east to confer with Compton. In his memoirs, Atomic Quest, Compton explains that he and Oppenheimer agreed that, unless they came up with a firm and reliable conclusion that our atomic bombs could not explode the air or the sea, these bombs must never be made. Compton reflected, better to accept the slavery of the Nazis than to run a chance of drawing the final curtain on mankind. Back at Berkeley, Bethe performed some additional calculations and discovered that Teller hadn't accounted for the heat that would be absorbed by radiation, which lowered the odds of blowing up the world to 3 in 1 million, a risk they were willing to chance. On December 2, 1942, the scientists at Met Lab succeeded in creating the first sustained nuclear chain reaction. Given the lack of safety precautions, it's lucky they didn't blow up the city of Chicago. Szilard and Italian emigre Enrico Fermi shook hands in front of the reactors as the scientists toasted with Chianti in paper cups to salute Fermi's leadership. Szilard, however, appreciated what a bittersweet moment it actually was, and warned Fermi that December 2nd would go down as a black day in the history of mankind. He was right. Slow out of the gate, the United States now embarked on a crash program, the Manhattan Project, under Brigadier General Leslie Groves in late 1942. Groves appointed Oppenheimer to organize and head the project's main laboratory at Los Alamos, in New Mexico's beautiful Sangre de Cristo Mountains. Most onlookers assumed that the relationship between Groves and Oppenheimer would be a marriage made in hell. They were opposites in every imaginable way. Groves weighed more than twice as much as the pencil-thin scientist, who, despite being over 6 feet tall, weighed 128 pounds at the start of the project and 115 by the end. Groves came from poverty, Oppenheimer from wealth. They were different in religion, taste in foods, smoking and drinking habits, and especially politics. Groves was a staunch conservative, Oppenheimer an unapologetic leftist, most of whose students, friends, and family members were communists. He admitted that he was a member of every Communist Party front group on the West Coast. At one point, he had given 10% of his monthly salary to the Communist Party to support the Republican forces in Spain. Oppenheimer and Groves were also opposites in temperament. Whereas Oppenheimer was beloved by most of those who knew him, Groves was universally despised. Groves's assistant, Lieutenant Colonel Kenneth Nichols, said that his boss was the biggest SOB I have ever worked for. He described him as demanding, critical, abrasive and sarcastic, intelligent, and the most egotistical man I know. Nichols admitted that he hated his guts and so did everyone else. But Groves's gruff, bullying, take-no-prisoners style actually complemented Oppenheimer's ability to inspire and get the most out of his colleagues in driving the project forward to completion. That is not to suggest that the scientists and the military didn't clash over security provisions and other matters. Where possible, Oppenheimer ran interference for the scientists and eased the suffocating grip of military control. Sometimes Oppie, as his friends called him, made his point humorously. On one occasion, Groves told Oppenheimer that he didn't want him to wear his signature pork pie hats because they made him too recognizable. When Groves next entered Oppenheimer's office, he found him wearing a full Indian headdress, which Oppenheimer proclaimed he would continue to wear until the end of the war. Groves ultimately relented. As the bomb project progressed steadily, so did the Allied effort in the Pacific. By 1944, the United States was capturing more and more Japanese-occupied territories, eventually bringing Japan itself within the range of U.S. bombers. In July 1944, the combined chiefs of staff under General George Marshall, a future Secretary of State and Nobel Peace Prize winner, adopted a two-pronged strategy to win the Pacific War. First, strangle Japan with an air and sea blockade and pummel the country with intensive air bombardment. Then, with Japan's military weakened and morale lowered, invade. In June 1944, as Allied forces advanced in both the European and Pacific theaters, Churchill and Roosevelt finally delivered on the long-delayed Second Front, landing 100,000 troops on the beach at Normandy, France. German forces, retreating from the Soviet advance, would now have to fight a real two-front war. On July 9th, U.S. forces took Saipan. The toll was enormous. 30,000 Japanese troops and 22,000 civilians were killed or committed suicide. The United States counted almost 3,000 dead and over 10,000 wounded in the nearly month-long combat, its highest battle toll to date in the Pacific. For most Japanese leaders, the calamitous defeat offered definitive proof that military victory could not be won. On July 18th, Prime Minister Hideki Tojo and his cabinet resigned. The next day, just as news of Tojo's resignation began to circulate, the Democratic National Convention opened in Chicago. Franklin D. Roosevelt easily secured the nomination for an unprecedented fourth term. The real contest was over the vice presidency. Henry Wallace had incurred the wrath of party conservatives by calling for a worldwide people's revolution, toward which end the United States and Soviet Union would work together, and by championing the cause of labor unions, women, African Americans, and the victims of European colonialism. His enemies included Wall Street bankers and other anti-union business interests, Southern segregationists, and defenders of British and French colonialism. William Stevenson, head of British intelligence in New York, even deployed Roald Dahl to spy on Wallace when the RAF lieutenant and future writer was posted to Washington, D.C. In 1944, Dahl got hold of a draft of Wallace's forthcoming pamphlet, Our Job in the Pacific. What he read, he said, made my hair stand on end. Wallace called for the emancipation of colonial subjects in British India, Malaya and Burma, French Indochina, the Dutch East Indies, and many small Pacific islands. Dahl secreted the manuscript out of Wallace's friend's home and rushed it to British officials to copy and transmit to British intelligence and Churchill. I was later told, Dahl reminisced, that Churchill could hardly believe what he was reading. Wallace wrote in his diary that the entire British Secret Service was shaking with indignation, as well as the British Foreign Office. British leaders pressured Roosevelt to censure and part ways with his vice president. Stevenson remarked, I came to regard Wallace as a menace, and I took action to ensure that the White House was aware that the British government would view with concern Wallace's appearance on the ticket at the 1944 presidential elections. Dahl, whose main job in Washington was monitoring Wallace's activities, the two regularly walked and played tennis together, said his friend was a lovely man, but too innocent and idealistic for this world. It was precisely because most of the world did not agree with Dahl's assessment that Wallace posed such a threat. In March 1943, Wallace embarked on a 40-day, seven-nation goodwill tour of Latin America. Speaking in Spanish, he electrified his audiences. He stopped first in Costa Rica, where 65,000 people, 15% of that nation's population, turned out to greet him. The reception accorded Mr. Wallace was the greatest in the history of Costa Rica, the New York Times reported. But that was just the beginning. 300,000 greeted his plane in Chile. More than 1 million cheered him as he walked through the streets of Santiago, arm in arm with President Juan Antonio Rios. 100,000 people, 20,000 over capacity, packed the stadium to hear him speak. Ambassador Claude Bowers reported to Washington, "Never in Chilean history has any foreigner been received with such extravagance and evidently sincere enthusiasm. His simplicity of manner, his mingling with all sorts of people, his visit to the workers' quarters without notice, and his inspection of the housing projects absolutely amazed the masses, who responded almost hysterically." In Ecuador, he spoke movingly of the post-war future at the University of Guayaquil. "If the liberation of the people for which the fight is going on today, with the blood of youth and the sweat of workers, results in imperialism and oppression tomorrow, this terrible war will have been in vain," he declared. "If this sacrifice of blood and strength again brings a concentration of riches in the hands of a few, great fortunes for the privileged and poverty for the people in general, then democracy will have failed, and all this sacrifice will have been in vain." 200,000 welcomed him to Lima. The trip was not only a personal triumph, it was a diplomatic tour de force. When it was over, a dozen Latin American countries had declared war on Germany, and 20 had broken diplomatic relations. Wallace was equally popular back home. While he was away, Gallup asked Democratic voters whether they viewed favorably or unfavorably each of the four leading contenders to replace Roosevelt if he decided not to run again. Wallace's 57% favorability rating more than doubled that of his nearest competitor. Wallace's acclaim made it even more urgent for his detractors to make their move. Knowing that Roosevelt's failing health meant he would not survive a fourth term, the party bosses decided to oust Wallace from the ticket and replace him with someone more amenable to the party's conservative factions. In 1944, they staged what was known among insiders as Pauley's Coup, named after Democratic Party treasurer and oil millionaire Edwin Pauley. Pauley had once quipped that he went into politics when he realized that it was cheaper to elect a new Congress than to buy up the old one. Pauley's co-conspirators included Edward Flynn of the Bronx, Mayor Edward Kelly of Chicago, Mayor Frank Haig of Jersey City, Postmaster General and former party chairman Frank Walker, Party Secretary George Allen, and National Democratic Party Chairman Robert Hannigan. After going through the list of potential candidates, the party bosses chose undistinguished Missouri Senator Harry Truman to replace Wallace. They picked Truman not because he had any substantial qualifications for the position, but because he had been sufficiently innocuous as a senator that he had made few enemies and he could be counted on not to rock the boat. They gave little, if any, thought to the attributes that would be necessary to lead the United States and the world in the challenging times ahead, when decisions would be made that would shape the course of history. Thus, Truman's ascent to the presidency, like much of his career, was a product of backroom deal-making by corrupt party bosses. Although Harry Truman left office with approval ratings so low that only George W. Bush has come close, he is now widely viewed as a nearly great president and routinely showered with praise by Republicans and Democrats alike. Former National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, whom George W. Bush credited with telling me everything I know about the Soviet Union, named Truman her man of the century to Time. Some historians have fallen into the same trap, none more than David McCullough, whose hagiographic biography of Truman won him a Pulitzer Prize. The real Harry Truman is more interesting than McCullough's fanciful one. Truman overcame a very difficult childhood, one that took a great toll on his psyche. Growing up on his family's Missouri farm, he struggled to win the affection of his father, John Peanuts Truman. The elder Truman, though only 5'4", relished beating up much taller men to show how tough he was. He wanted the same toughness in his sons. He found it in Harry's younger brother, Vivian. Harry, however, was diagnosed with hypermetropia, or flat eyeballs, and forced to wear Coke bottle-thick glasses, so he couldn't play sports or roughhouse with the other boys. I was afraid my eyes would get knocked out if there was too much of a rough-and-tumble play, he explained. To tell the truth, I was kind of a sissy. He was picked on and bullied by the other boys, who called him Four Eyes and Sissy, and chased him home after school. To make matters worse, when he arrived home trembling and out of breath, his mother would comfort him by telling him not to worry because he was meant to be a girl anyway. He wrote about one incident in a 1912 letter. That sounds rather feminine, doesn't it? Mama says I was intended for a girl anyway. It makes me pretty mad to be told so, but I guess it's partly so. He later reflected that being regarded as a sissy was hard on a boy. It makes him lonely, and it gives him an inferiority complex, and he has a hard time overcoming it. Not surprisingly, gender issues plagued him for years. He often referred to his feminine features and attributes. He would later prove that not only was he not a sissy, he could stand up to Stalin and show him who was boss. Economic hardship also plagued him. Although he was a good student, with a serious interest in history, his family's economic circumstances made it impossible for him to attend college. After graduating from high school, he bounced around for a while before returning to work on his father's farm. He also got involved in 3 failed business ventures and didn't experience real success until his service in the First World War, when he served bravely and honorably in France. His final business venture, a haberdashery that went belly up in 1922, left the 38-year-old Truman with a wife to support and limited prospects. It was at that low point that party boss Tom Pendergast offered to get Truman elected judge in Jackson County. During the campaign, Truman, who was always bigoted and anti-Semitic, sent a $10 check to the Ku Klux Klan, but was denied membership because he would not promise to stop hiring Catholics. Truman remained a loyal member of the notorious Pendergast machine throughout the 1920s and early 1930s, but felt as if he were getting nowhere in life. On the eve of his 49th birthday in 1933, he mused, "Tomorrow I'll be 49, but for all the good I've done, the 40 might as well be left off." The following year, just when Truman had wearied of machine politics and was contemplating a return to the farm, boss Pendergast picked him to run for the Senate. His first 4 choices had turned him down, and engineered his election. When asked why he had chosen someone as unqualified as Truman to run, Pendergast replied, "I wanted to demonstrate that a well-oiled machine could send an office boy to the Senate." Known derisively among his new Senate colleagues as the Senator from Pendergast, and shunned by most of them, Truman worked hard to gain respectability in Washington, a stature he finally achieved during his second term in the Senate. He almost didn't get that second term. Failing to win Roosevelt's endorsement, Truman eked out re-election to the Senate in 1940 by a razor-thin margin, with the help of the St. Louis Hannigan-Dickman machine, while Pendergast languished in federal prison. Truman now owed favors to 2 corrupt urban machines. Roosevelt, meanwhile, was staking his own political future on the choice of the high-minded Wallace as his vice-presidential running mate, taking comfort in the knowledge that Wallace's progressive ideals would help steer the country through the rocky times ahead. The American people showed much better judgment than the party bosses. When Gallup asked likely Democratic voters in a Gallup poll released on July 20, 1944, during the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, who they wanted on the ticket as vice president, 65% selected Henry Wallace. Jimmy Burns of South Carolina, who would later exert so much influence over Truman's Cold War thinking and atomic bomb decision, received 3% of the vote, with Wallace even trouncing him by a 6-to-1 margin in the South. Truman came in 8th out of 8 candidates, with the support of 2% of those polled. But Roosevelt, tired, ailing, and dependent on the bosses for re-election, was not willing or able to fight for Wallace as he had in 1940. He simply announced that were he a delegate, he would vote for Wallace. Party leaders made sure they had an iron grip on the convention. Yet the rank-and-file Democrats would not go quietly, staging a rebellion on the convention floor. The groundswell of support for Wallace among the delegates and attendees was so great that despite the boss's stranglehold over the proceedings and strong-arm tactics, Wallace's supporters almost carried the day as an uproarious demonstration for Wallace broke out on the convention floor. In the midst of the demonstration, Florida Senator Claude Pepper realized that if he got Wallace's name into nomination that night, Wallace would sweep the convention. Pepper fought his way through the crowd to get within 5 feet of the microphone when the nearly hysterical Mayor Kelly, purporting that there was a fire hazard, got the chairman, Senator Samuel Jackson, to adjourn the proceedings. Had Pepper made it 5 more feet and nominated Wallace before the bosses